Good morning, everybody. Sunday morning, philosophy, chitty chatty, bing bang. Hope you're doing well. Do you care? Probably not about my thoughts because it's a call-in show. So let's do it that way and let's go straight to summer. What is on your mind? How can philosophy help you today?
Hello? How are you doing, Seth? Great to get back. I got two questions. One of them was, I can understand with the anarcho-capitalism privatization, how private healthcare and public, or private healthcare and education, that people pay as they go, you know, that there's no, very little taxes. How would it private law and order work? Like, I can't understand private police force and private law and order, that like Google would send their private police force to arrest Bezos, and Bezos was used his private police force to defend himself. Like, that's basically a war at that point, isn't it?
Right. So public and private, just want to be annoying about the language. Remember, all language is invented by your enemies. Very, very important thing. I'll get to the question, I promise. But just remember, so when you say public, private, we don't say that a theft is public charity, but charity is private charity. We don't say that sexual assault is public sex, but lovemaking, voluntary, consensual, happy, joy, lovemaking is private sex. So public and private are a way of covering up the violence of public. Public means by fiat, it means by decree, it means by force. Well, let me ask you this. Let's take a look at my origin story, the United Kingdom. How do you think policing is going there?
There's problems.
There's problems? You think? A guy just got thrown in jail for 2 years for saying that he had an issue with migrants taking housing and jobs. How many people were killed in the 20th century by their own governments outside of war?
A lot, too many.
250 million. It's a quarter of a billion people, or about 3.5 days in the abortion industry. So the question to me is, compared to what, right? So you always say, compared to what? And again, I will answer. I was just to say why the question I think is important to dig into. So compared to what? So when governments kill their own citizens, they usually use the police force to arrest and incarcerate them. I mean, this is what happened to Solzhenitsyn. This is what happened to Dostoevsky and so on in Russia under two different regimes, the Tsarist regime and the communist regime. So the police come over and they arrest you and then they throw you in prison and so on. So the quarter of a billion people were not killed by armies. They were incarcerated, and then, you know, they were incarcerated by police and then, you know, killed by gulag chiefs or whatever, and usually all under the auspices of the law. So the problem that we have as a whole, and it's a problem everyone has, so this is nothing particular to you, and it's a very interesting problem, is we say what is okay and change is risky. And change is risky in society because change can go either towards something more free, as in the American Revolution, or it can go someplace completely horrendous, like the French Revolution. I've got 12 hours on the French Revolution available for donors at premium.freedomain.com. So what is okay, and change is bad, right? And people have this with dysfunctional families all the time. You know, I kind of get it. I kind of map it. It's okay. It's somewhat, you know, acceptable. It's familiar. And change would be disruptive and bad. And maybe I'd end up completely alone and things like that. So that's one of the problems that we have. Now, the problem with things being okay right now is they're not. The police generally will follow the dictates of the state, and the police very rarely have refused to enforce laws. And so in general, a government power grows until a collapse of society, right? Fiat currency always goes to zero. I mean, with the exception of the British pound, which has been about 400 years, but still has lost 98% of its value. So the compared to what is important. So if you and I were on an airplane that was had been hijacked or something, right? And we were over water and we were, you know, a couple of hundred feet above the water, but they were going to destroy the plane and fly it somewhere bad. And I said, we've got to jump. And you'd say, well, but that's a long way down. And the water is, you know, when you hit at that speed, it's, you know, it's dangerous. And okay, agreed, agreed. But compared to what? Compared to things getting worse and worse until the end. So that's the first thing that I would say. Now, the second thing that I would say, and this is going to be something that you can participate in if you like, I can either just lecture it. It's usually better with a back and forth. So why don't you be someone I'm trying to sell my free market police forces to, and you can ask me all the questions that you would be skeptical about, right? So I knock on your door. Hello, Mr. Summer. I'm from the Stefbot Protection Services, and I would love to sell you our services. And let's say you just come from some government society or whatever. And what was the first question you would ask me?
Do I have to sign up? No, I don't. Let me see. Do you have a pamphlet?
Do you have to sign up? No. This is a voluntary free market society. You don't have to sign up at all. But it is absolutely in your best interests to sign up, and it will keep your property safe. It will keep your children safe. It will keep you safe. And if you ever have any disputes with people, you know, we are a phone call away. We will make sure that it's resolved in a just and expeditious fashion. And so everyone on the street has this. I mean, some people have different protection agencies, but the Stefbot Protection Agency is number one. And, you know, you don't want to be roaming around in society with no protection from thieves and scammers and cheats and liars and so on, and people who don't send you, you know, whatever you ask them for. You pay for something online and you never get it. Like, we'll deal with all of that. We'll resolve all of that. And because you've signed up for us, you get a special logo by your name online, which says that the Stefbot Protection Agency is going to be all over their shit if they treat you badly. And so you don't have to sign up with us. You don't have to sign up with anyone, of course. But then people will know you don't have a protection agency, and you're probably going to be more likely to be preyed upon because you don't have, you know, big burly Stefbot Protection Agency in your corner. So I'm just telling you, it's for your benefit. It's crazy cheap, and you'll probably never need to call us. But that's in part because you already have us. You have our logo. You're in our database. Everybody knows that you're protected. I mean, let's say that somebody steals your car tomorrow. What are you going to do?
Yeah, neighbor. Like, I have problems with my neighbor, and like he keeps interfering with my lawn at the back. And he's with the Stiff Boot, I think, protection company. Is your company bigger than the Stiff Boot? Like, could you take them if it came down to it?
Well, let me ask you this: have you ever traveled with your cell phone?
Yes.
Okay, so let's say you go to some, like right now, let's just say you go to some new country with your cell phone. Does it work?
Sometimes I go up to Northern Ireland and the cell phone doesn't work, or it wipes all my data or credit or something, yeah.
I'm sorry, in Northern Ireland, your cell phone erases? What are you talking about?
If I go up to Northern Ireland, I don't have free data. Like, down the south in the Republic of Ireland, I have free all-you-can-eat data. So, okay.
But if you pay, right? Let's say that's because you're, well, frugal, I suppose we could say. Some might say cheap. I consider that crazy talk. But you don't pay for additional data, right? So if you paid more per month, you could go to Northern Ireland or you could go to Australia and your data would still work. Is that fair to say?
Correct.
So how is it that your data can work in Australia when you don't have any deals or relationships with the Australian cell phone companies?
I don't know. Why is it? Because of... why is that actually? I don't know. My network provider, my cell phone provider, does a deal with them or something, it charges both.
Yeah, they work together. So your cell phone provider locally in Southern Ireland will have a deal with a cell phone provider in Australia, and they will just exchange data. And let me ask you this: have you ever sent an email to somebody not in your town?
If I got into a dispute with my neighbor and he's with the stiff boot.
No, hang on. Sorry. I'm not sure if you caught that question. We're cutting out a bit. So when you send an email, let's say you send an email to someone in Australia, it goes through a whole bunch of different data networks that you don't have any relationship with, right? Like you pay for your own local internet provider and then they hand it off to like 20 other computers to get to Australia. Is that a fair way to put it?
Correct. Is that called outsourcing or?
Well, sometimes it's called co-opetition, which is companies will cooperate, like cell phone companies will cooperate in order to have you go on their networks so that everyone can provide a better value. But it's companies working together to solve problems for their customers. So when you go to Australia, you can use your cell phone. When you send an email across the world, then the email is handed off to like 20 different corporations who have 20 different servers or, 2,000 different servers. And so companies work together to solve problems for their customers. In other words, if you have one cell phone company that says your cell phone is only going to work 20 miles from your home, that's not particularly valuable. However, if you have a cell phone company that says your cell phone will work all around the world, and let's say you travel a lot, then that's more valuable. So they'll figure out a way to do it. So me, as the representative of the StuffBot Protection Agency, we've worked out deals. So if you have someone, like it wouldn't be much value to say, we'll protect you from people in society if we could only protect you from other people who signed up for our services, right? So we recognize that's a big business problem. So what we've done is we've created a series of contracts with all of the other protection agencies. And if we, for some reason, don't have a contract with the protection agency, we will still negotiate on your behalf because they want to provide services and protection for their customers. We want to provide services and protection to our customers. And we all recognize that if you have Bob's protection agency and you're signed up to StuffBots and Bob's agency won't listen to me or we won't listen to them, then there's a problem in society, like the big conflict that could escalate. Maybe you start shooting at each other with all of the legally available guns because it's a free society. So we have made sure that we have arrangements and agreements with your neighbor's protection company so that we can, in a way that's transparent to you, we can resolve these issues. And I can show you all of those details. I can give you all the case studies. But in the same way, you go to Australia, it's just like you're at home. If you're dealing with us if you become our customer and we have to deal with Bob's protection agency, it would be transparent to you. We'll work it out with Bob's protection agency because it's to our advantage to have these reciprocal arrangements, just like cell phone providers, just like data providers, and so on.
Okay, so my neighbor is Bob, basically, and he's kind of doing something with my back lawn, and he's got a different protection company. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so you go and negotiate with him what's going on with the situation in the back garden or whatever.
Yes. So is he building a garden shed on your property or something like that? Let's just make up an example.
Exactly, something like that. Or it could be small. It does.
How did it used to go in your old country, like in your government-run country? What would happen if Bob was building a shed of his on your property? You'd call the police, and then what would happen?
Solicitors would be involved, wouldn't it, pretty much?
And how long do you think that would take to resolve, and how expensive would it be?
It'd be pretty expensive, I reckon. I don't know.
Let me ask you a different question. Have you ever tried to use the police in a government society to resolve a somewhat complicated property dispute?
I actually haven't. I very rarely need the police force or law enforcement for anything. I'm not being smart, but I'm sure we could abstract to just create a situation again to try and make the point and try and work.
Okay. Have you ever known anyone who's tried to use the legal system to resolve a fairly complicated dispute?
I'm sure I have, but they probably haven't let me in on the. Zone. Like I go down to the law. I go down to the court sometimes just to spectate in my local town here, just to see the proceedings, you know. But
the average lawsuit takes years and costs 10, 50, 100,000 pounds.
Yeah, which is huge.
So the problem is, you think that you're in a system that works, and you're asking how a different system could work. And that's a fine question to ask. The question is, does your existing system work? And anyone who's tried to use, I mean, I personally, just me as Steph, I've tried, and actually I've used the legal system a number of times to protect my interests and to deal with people who've done me wrong. It's crazy. It's crazy. So it's not a system that works at the moment. The law system is largely used to threaten political opponents, to throw free speech, people exercising free speech in jail, and so on. So the existing system doesn't work. And if you've ever talked to someone who's tried to remedy a fairly complicated wrong, I mean, I had a fairly complicated wrong probably 25 years ago, went to a lawyer, and he said it'll take 5 to 10 years and $500,000 to resolve. I mean, just read the beginning of Bleak House, right? The law is designed to punish political opponents. The law is designed to make lawyers rich. And the law is designed to impose political will. The law is not designed to helpfully and easily and efficiently resolve disputes between citizens, because the law is designed by the government for the government. It's not designed by the people for the people. But a private system of law is designed by and for the people, because if I'm not able to please you, I don't get your business. And I want your business, so that's why we're talking. So if you have this issue, okay, tell me, so you got your issue with Bobby's building a shed on your property. What needs to be done, just practically, to resolve the dispute? What do you think needs to be done? What should be done?
Property lines to be...
Oh, he may have just crossed over into Northern Ireland. Are you back?
Hello, beg your pardon. Hello,
Testing
1-2.
Go ahead. So, yeah, maybe this can work as a dialogue. Maybe I'll just do it as a monologue. We'll try one more time. What do you think needs to be done to deal with your property dispute with Bob?
The two's property has to be clearly delineated. My property and his has to be clearly delineated. And then, I suppose, if he's got, let's just say for discussion's sake, he's got the foundation built of the shed. It's not fully built yet. You know, it would be nice to see that he's not building it on the property anymore. So would you have to use four?
Well, so it's a pretty simple process with this particular dispute. So you have property lines, which are registered when you buy the property. So you have property lines. If he's building on your property, then what he needs to do is to, well, we need to look at the property lines and see if he's building on your property. I mean, that's a day or two at most, right? You ditch GPS out. Oh, he's on your property lines and so on, right? So if he's building on your property without your permission, then he's in violation of his of property rights. So then, of course, he needs to remove what he's built, and he needs to restore your property back to its original state, whatever that is, right? And I also think, personally, the way that we work is, if somebody inconveniences you in an obvious fashion, right? Like, he didn't check with you, he didn't check with the property diagrams in order to make sure he's building in the right place, then he pays you for all of the time, effort, and energy, and he pays you for any costs that have occurred for you. And given that your hourly rate, you know, $50, $100, whatever it is, and let's say you spent 12 hours dealing with it, then he owes you, you know, $1,200, $600, or something like that. So we will make sure, we will go and talk to his dispute resolution organization, we call them DROs. So the Stefbot guys will go talk to his guys, and we will say, look, here's the facts, right? I mean, here's the property lines, here's the GPS, here's the aerial photo. He's totally building on the property, and he's got to remove it. And they would go to him and say, yeah, you know, they've made their case. We accept their case. It's pretty open and shut. So you've got to remove it. And you also have to restore his property to its original. And you also have to pay for his time. And so, and he says, well, I don't want to do any of that. I'm not going to do it. And then they would say, no, you signed a contract, bro. Like, we have this in writing. You signed a contract that if you are judged against, you will do what the remedy is. And he says, well, screw you, Bob's Protection Company. I'm totally attached to this shed on my neighbor's property. I am not going to. And then they say, okay, listen, the remedy is, we obviously withdraw all our services, number one. And what that means is you can't have any contracts in this society. Like, if you don't keep your contract with us, we have all of these reciprocal arrangements with everyone. You can't, like, you now have a bad contract rating. And that means you can't buy groceries. That means you can't buy electricity. That means you can't buy heating. That means you can't buy gas for your car. That means you can't drive on anyone's roads. So you are now locked inside your house. Because if you go and violate other people's property, then we have the right to use force. So
basically,
go ahead.
Your police force, or your police force, the two police forces would see that Bob was wrong, and that they would come to a consensus and kind of lock him out of the system or something. Or
sure, yeah. I mean, it's like the social credit system, but for good, not evil. So in order to, I mean, even for you and I to have this conversation, we have to have a whole bunch of contracts, right? I mean, you have a contract with your bank if you're mortgaging a house. You have a contract with your cell phone company or your internet provider. You even had a contract to some degree when you went to go and buy your computer, right? I mean, they give you the computer you have to buy, and you have a contract for the warranty. So you have contract for heating and electricity. And so everything that goes on in society is this big whirling interweb of contracts. And if people don't want to do business with you, you can't really survive in society. I mean, you can survive, I suppose. You go live in the woods or whatever it is, but that's not what most people want to do, and certainly if they already have property. So the deal is you fulfill your contracts and you agree to obey objective adjudications. Now, of course, there's an escalation process, because sometimes these DROs, the police, they can get it wrong. Sure, they can get it wrong. So then there'll always be, you know, if there's a dispute, you can escalate. And if it is found that we did something wrong, we will pay you. We will, you know, give you, 5 years free service or something like that. But if you escalate and it turns out we were in the right, you've got to pay all those costs, because you always have to have a jeopardy involved with things. So you have a system which is designed to be as fast, as efficient as possible. And you have a system. See, the way that policing works now is like the way that socialized medicine works, which is they only gain value when there's a problem. Now, I don't want to pay people who only gain value when there's a problem. I want to pay people who prevent problems from coming into being. So clearly, if somebody is building a shed on your property, there's something wrong with their brain. Like, they're just making bad decisions. So, you know, we would want to deal with that beforehand, you know, their brain scan or whatever, like something's going wrong with their brain, that they're just making these crazy decisions. Now, if he's just like a mean guy or a sociopath or an evil guy or just a bully or something like that, well, where do they come from? Well, they come from child abuse. So DROs would be heavily involved with peaceful parenting, because you pay to not have problems. Right? You pay to not have problems. People don't usually want to pay to fix problems. They want to pay to prevent problems, which is why a rational private system of healthcare would be to proactively help you manage your health and weight so you didn't get sick, or at least didn't get sick in an obviously preventable fashion, as opposed to now, people just wait basically till you get sick, and then they make a bunch of money off you being sick. It's like the worst possible incentive. Nobody makes any money in the healthcare system from prevention. And so if you're paying people in a private system for healthcare, then they make the most money when you don't need healthcare, which means that they will invest in making sure they'll give you blood work, they'll give you exercise tips, they'll pay for personal trainers, they'll make sure you get to the gym, like whatever it is that they need to do to prevent you from getting sick. And this does happen to some degree, like insurance is cheaper if you don't smoke, you know, things like that. So what you want is a society that is built from the ground up to prevent problems, not to remediate problems. You know, that there's something that this is something I learned in the software industry, that if you try to change the design or characteristics of complex software near the end of the project, it's at least 10 times and sometimes 20 times more difficult to do it near the end than at the beginning, which is why I would spend forever and ever with the clients across the table hammering back and forth, what does the software do? What do you want the software to do? You know, we'd have a list of features, they'd want to adjust a few, whatever, wire it into existing systems, and you'd say, okay, so we need to design everything now. Right? Like if you design a car from the ground up, you say, you order a car and you say, I want a sunroof, right? Okay, then that's fairly easy to do when you're making the car. It's a little bit more difficult to do if you already have the car and then you say, now I want a sunroof. They've got to go in and cut it and put in the reinforcement stuff and all of that. So when you solve problems at the beginning, they are much less difficult later on. And I did track this, and I would tell customers, you know, like, if you want me to change this later, it's going to cost you an arm and a leg, and we're going to have a difficult relationship. And so let's hammer out all the design documents at the beginning, get them all signed off, nailed down, understood. And then we can go do the project and it'll actually be quite a lot of fun. And we'll go to comedy clubs when we meet up. And we actually did that with clients and it's great. So preventing problems from coming into being is what society really needs to do. And that's not what society is doing. What society is doing is people are making a huge amount of money from problems existing rather than problems not existing. Now, in the free market, it is far cheaper to invest in parenting than it is to invest in incarcerating criminals. Incarcerating criminals is crazy expensive. Millions and millions of dollars. Well, per criminal, it can be $1 million or $2 million or $3 million if they've been in prison for a long time and so on. And so if you look at that money and how much is spent on chasing criminals, catching criminals, trying criminals, incarcerating criminals, trying to rehabilitate criminals, and all of the property damage and life damage, paranoia damage, the ripple effect of crime is staggering in society. It's hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars per country to have crime. And that's just the money. The quality of life stuff is really important as well. Like, people don't feel comfortable roaming the neighborhood. So when you look at all of the horrible things that happen as a result of crime, not just violent crime, which is obvious, but even trust crime, like white collar crime and fraud and so on. It's horrible. Now, if you say we could either spend hundreds of billions of dollars and have a terrible society, or what we could do is we could heavily invest in peaceful parenting, and a free society would heavily invest in peaceful parenting because it's just way cheaper. You can train someone on peaceful parenting for $5,000 or $10,000, along with some monitoring and some follow-up and so on. And that's compared to hundreds of billions of dollars or trillions of dollars on crime and its sort of associated related problems, dysfunctions, issues, and so on. I mean, it's just horrible. So it's way cheaper to parent well than to fix crime at the tail end. But there's no incentive because nobody makes money from parenting well. And you could say, well, but what if people don't want to do peaceful parenting? It's like, well, that's fine, but then they're going to be ostracized from society. Right? I mean, nobody's going to want to do business with them. No other kids are going to want to play with them. No other parents are going to let their kids over and so on. So again, you just have to have these sort of incentives and consequences. So we need a society where we focus on preventing crimes. The free market focuses on preventing crimes. And this Bob, who's doing something really dumb and intrusive and mean, which is building a shed on your property, but that's the end of a whole series of bad decisions made by his parents, made by him, and it's just way easier to prevent these things. And it's hard for us to even imagine what it's like to have a society that focuses on preventing problems from coming into being, because that is the most profitable thing for society as a whole. I mean, I get cancer treatment centers make money from treating cancer, and you need to treat cancer. People get cancer and so on, right? Sometimes it's just a function of aging. But it's the second killer after heart disease, I think. So, and I understand that the people who treat cancer need to make money from treating cancer and so on. But you also need a counterweight in society, which is people who make money from preventing cancer from occurring, at least for as long as possible. So we don't have that really in society. We don't have prevention of problem situations. In society, we have everyone just makes money from playing whack-a-mole with problems. Like another example would be drugging kids, like drugging particularly boys in school. Like, why are boys having such trouble paying attention in school? Because school is designed for girls and NPCs, and like thoughtful, aggressive, assertive boys, restless boys go slowly insane in that system. It really is like, it's like trying to take a lion and feed him salad. He's just going to go slowly crazy. And so people make a lot of money out of drugging boys. They're all paid for by the government and debt and so on. And then if you get your kid listed as having a mental health disorder, you get additional welfare money or social security money and so on. So people are making a fortune from drugging boys. And who would possibly make any money from redesigning the educational system to be more boy friendly so that boys get up and are eager to go to school? Like, I get up every morning, I'm eager to do my show. Like, I got up this morning, I had a lovely breakfast with my wife and my daughter, and we had lovely chats, and we were actually chatting till 2 o'clock in the morning last night because we were just on a great conversation roll. And then I'm like really eager to come and do this show. I love learning. I love studying. I love writing books. And I obviously I have a bit of a talent that way, but most people are like that. Most people want to learn. Most people enjoy learning things. Most people are excited to get a hold of information, but nobody is able to reform the educational system because it's surrounded by coercion. So your thoughts are perfectly understandable, and this is nothing negative towards you, but they're very common in human history. And it goes back to like, well, if the government doesn't provide X service will not be provided, right? If the government doesn't educate children, how will children be educated? Well, first of all, the government is not educating children at the moment. The government is simply boring them and propagandizing them. That's all it's doing. 98% of everything you ever learned in 12 years of education is gone and forgotten. And you really remember this, you know, when you try and teach your own kids, if you homeschool, try and teach your own kids, like, how do you do long division by hand? Like, I spent years on that. And I'm like, still got to go look it up. I don't remember because I never use it, right? It's all completely pointless, boring, busy work. And the educational system is there to inflict Marxism on the young and to take forced union dues and shovel them to left-wing causes and political parties. That doesn't exist for the children. Or as one of the executives famously said, one of the union executives, like, I'll start focusing on kids when kids can vote. And it's kind of true, right? So it's really about preventing problems. Preventing problems from coming into being is the most economically efficient and productive thing to do, but nobody makes any money from it in a government society. People make money from stimulating problems and then pretending to solve them. So the idea of like, well, throughout all of human history, slaves have picked the crops and done all the labor. And it's like, well, so if slaves pick all the crops, if we end slavery, everyone's going to starve to death because the crops won't be picked. Oh, they'll be way too expensive or whatever. But that's not what happens, of course. When slavery ends, you get massive labor-saving devices to replace the slaves, and everything ends up way more efficient. And it's the same thing with police, if that makes sense.
What's your thoughts on the Pareto distribution and the protection agencies and the natural Pareto distribution? What's your thoughts on that?
Now, this is an odd interaction. Very interesting. So I've been talking to you for almost 40 minutes, right?
Correct. Yeah, about that, I don't know.
And you've come to me with some very difficult questions, right?
Possibly.
Sorry, what do you mean possibly? They're very difficult questions. If they weren't difficult, you would have answered them yourself, right? This is where the conversation may get a little bit awkward, but I'm genuinely trying to help you. So I've been studying this stuff for 40, 45 years. I've written books on it. I've done debates. And I'm giving you a very easy to digest synthesis of almost half a century of study, thought, and research, right?
Yeah.
So if somebody is giving you And of course, it's part of a show and all of that, so I get all of that. But if somebody is giving you the fruits of almost half a century of research in an easy-to-digest format that answers the questions, what would be the polite thing to do?
To be grateful and to be to say thanks for the answers. And I'm not. I don't know if the conversation is over, but you've definitely what you've said there about the consensus between the two free market protection agencies and that they would come to a consensus and the situation would be resolved. Yeah, I wasn't aware that that is interesting. But then I thought, oh yeah, what about the Pareto distribution and this natural, kind of monopolies and all the rest of it that happens at the free market. So that seemed like a concern. But yeah, absolutely. You definitely contributed some real interest. And
that's, sorry, truth. Just interrupt. So that's very interesting. I'm sure you've had the situation where you're driving in a car. Maybe this doesn't really happen anymore, but maybe when you were younger or you saw your father do this, you're driving in the car, you get lost and you stop someone by the side of the road and you say, which way is it to the museum? And then the person, you know, sits there for 5 minutes or so, draws you a map, tells you how to get there and so on. What do you normally say?
Thank you, sir.
Right. And that's interesting. And the reason I'm bringing this up is I want this to be sort of instructive for everyone that if you want people to give you knowledge for free, shouldn't you show some appreciation? And the reason I'm saying that is I don't want to answer your next question, right? I do want to answer people's questions. But if I work really hard, and I have for decades, to be able to answer these questions in an engaging and enjoyable fashion, I hope, then if I get no thanks, no appreciation, even if you disagree, like, hey, I don't agree, but thank you so much for laying it out this way, blah, blah, that's totally fine, right? Don't have to agree. But this is the result of decades of study and practice in explaining things. And if I spend, you know, almost 40 minutes engaging with you to try and explain something, and the answer is good, and you just hit me with the next question without any appreciation, I mean, would you want to, I mean, if you spend, half a day helping your friend move, and then he just says, oh yeah, no, I need some weeding down in the back too. No thanks. Do you want to weed for him?
No, but I think it was an interest.
I'm sorry, say again.
There's kind of reciprocity. Your viewers have possibly liked listening to the answer and to the stimulating question in the first place. You know, that it was arguably a stimulating question about the privatization of police forces and stuff. So, you know, yeah, I should be grateful of you, and it should be reciprocity though, you know.
What do you mean?
That I should be appreciative of you, and perhaps maybe should you be appreciative of the question in the first place, or no?
I did say thank you. It's a great question. So, but are you or me getting more value? Just forget the audience. Are you and me getting more value out of the question and the answer?
I hate to say it, but are you making money from this? I'm not making money from this.
I'm not making money from this. I mean, there is a general people donate and so on, right? But just into, like, I already have the answer. So just looking at the Q&A, and it's an interesting question, right? The economics of sort of public questions and answers, right? So I already have the answer. So giving you the answer in that sense is of almost infinitely more value to you than it is to me. Does that make sense?
Arguably, you definitely, you'd be like,
oh, I think he's coming and going.
Hello, test 1-2. So yeah, what you said there about that Bob's protection company and your protection company would come to a consensus. Yeah, I wasn't aware of that. So thank you. That did. I'm not fully convinced yet. But I'm not fully convinced to commit to anarcho-capitalism and how it worked. But what you said was definitely furthered the conversation and definitely contributed truth to your side of the conversation that I wasn't really aware of before the start. But I'm not so sure if the conversation is over. But you definitely contributed greatly to the conversation.
Well, and I appreciate that. And I'm not trying to be a nag. I'm really not. I mean, we'll survive either way. I'm just curious because maybe I was raised in England, went to boarding school and so on. So maybe this is a bit of the over politeness of sort of the British side of things. But if somebody you know, spends 40 minutes answering a challenging question for me. And again, fully convinced, fine. You know, obviously I wouldn't expect you to be fully convinced in something like this, but you know, it's a good answer. So it's just a question, and it's a very interesting question about appreciation. When, I mean, you just immediately went to the next question, showing no appreciation. And it's not even appreciation in terms of like, oh, thanks, Steph, for the answer. I had no idea whether my answer was of value to you or not. I had no idea whether I'd even answered your question to your satisfaction. I had no idea what you thought of my answer. You just went straight to the next question. Does that make sense? Like, I didn't know whether you were just moving on because you didn't understand, or moving on because I wasn't answering your question. Like, I had no feedback on my answer, and therefore I don't know. Like, if you say that was a great answer, I'll certainly mull it over. Thanks. And then you come with another question. At least I have some guidance as to whether what I'm doing is providing any value. So the thank you has to do with providing value. Like, if I stop to ask someone for directions and they try to sell me concert tickets, I'm not going to thank them because they're not actually providing value, right? And so one of the reasons we thank people is to inform them that they have provided value, which then informs the next answer that I provide. So if you say, you know, that was a fantastic answer, I love the way you approached it, thank you. And then I know that the way I'm approaching the answer is a value to you. But if you just move on to the next question without referencing the last 40 minutes, I have no idea whether I'm providing value to you or not. I have no idea whether my answers are good or bad. You could be moving on because you're just like, ah, oh, this guy just rambles, I don't understand. But I'll try one more question, you know, in hopes of. So a lack of feedback makes it hard for me to provide value, right? Like, you know, you order a slice of pizza, you get a little thing on the receipt that says, you know, rate your pizza, rate this, rate that. And that's because they want to know, you know, if they're providing value, if you like the pizza. And if not, you know, you get this every time you go to a meal, there's usually a little thing on the table, or sometimes, you know, Applebee's or whatever, and you can. So, and what's interesting is, I think this is where my frustration came from, is I spent 40 minutes working very hard to provide an answer. I don't know if I did anything of value to you. And so I didn't have any particular motivation to answer the next question, if that makes sense. So politeness has a very practical thing. Like, if you'd have said to me, Steph, this answer makes no sense at all, and I'm not convinced at all, and I think you've just completely missed the point of my question, then at least I know that I'm not providing value to you. But if you just move on to another question with no, it was kind of dizzying for me. Like, you know, I just spent 40 minutes trying to answer this very tough question, and then just moved on as if I hadn't said anything. You moved on as if it was my first question, if that makes sense. And again, I'm not trying to be a nag, but I'm just really want to be honest about my motivation. My motivation was like, whoa, hang on. I mean, I just spent 40 minutes answering this guy's question. Now he's just peppering me with another question with no feedback. And the feedback could be, Steph, none of what you said makes any sense. It's wrong. It doesn't have to be, oh, thanks, great answer, although I think it was a great answer. But how am I supposed to navigate providing value to you if you don't provide me feedback on the value I've already tried to provide? Does that make sense?
Yeah, good point. Yeah, 100%. I'll definitely keep that in mind. 100%.
All right. So what was your other question? No, I appreciate you listening to this meta conversation. So go ahead.
I don't know if you want to talk about it, or maybe it's because, yeah, it can get, it's just that I think my motivation for asking the second question is that, what you said with the two private protection agencies, it is interesting. I wasn't aware that that is, you definitely contributed great truth to your side of the conversation, and truth overall, about the two protection companies, and that they could come to a consensus that it was interesting. I hadn't thought of that. You know, originally it was, oh yeah, Google would send their private police force for Jeff Bezos, and then Jeff Bezos would send his police force to defend himself from Google, and it would be basically a war. What you contributed there with that the two protection companies would come to a consensus, and they'd have to check Bob for his.
Sorry, just because I just wanted to make, there already is a war. Like, it doesn't, there already is a war. And the war is that people voted for Donald Trump so that Donald Trump could control the borders and reduce the number of immigrants coming in for jobs. And that's what they voted for. That was very, very clear. And Donald Trump and his administration is trying to do that, and they keep getting blocked by all these judges. So there is already, the people have spoken and the people have said, here's what we want, and we vote for the government to do it, and the government is unable to do it because other elements within the government are blocking them. So we don't solve the war. The private protection agencies, that they have this issue of having to work with others and so on, but it's not like the problem is solved under the current system. So yeah, hit me with your second question, because the first one was great and I appreciate that. So if my answer was helpful, hit me with the second question and we'll see if we can solve that too.
Well, yeah, if you want to, I could, maybe 40 minutes is too much, but just maybe you could think about it in the meantime. I'll go off now, but it's to do with the Pareto distribution. What will stop private police forces, you know, forming kind of massive, like, I think the Pareto distribution, they got like 80% of the equity of the market, and they dominate, and, you know, so... Maybe we'll leave that. Maybe you could mull on that over if you want.
I have an answer to that. So it's a great question again. And when I say very common, I don't mean that it's like not intelligent or anything like that. But of course, it's a natural objection that when we see accumulations of power, we get cautious. And so the idea is that, let's say you have 20 protection agencies in a society and maybe a couple of mom and pop shops that still have the contracts with everyone, provide some local specialized service to the paint canning factory or something like that. And let's say, because the Pareto principle is that there's some people who are just unbelievably talented at stuff. Like, it's crazy. You see this everywhere. So like 99% of the money goes to 1% of the people, because 1% of the people are crazy talented. And if you've ever been around, I remember reading a comment on an old Billy Joel video about some guy who was like, oh yeah, we used to sing doo-wop on the street corners, and Billy Joel was just, he just blew us all out of the water, right? And we had a family friend staying. I actually recorded a couple of songs with her because she's a good singer and guitarist. And people who are good at that stuff, and particularly songwriting, I mean, there's no comparison. You know, there's just no comparison. And it's not like the Beatles are 20 times as good as your local bar band doing covers, right? I mean, they're like in a different universe. It's like infinity, right? And so I think the concern is that, let's say that the guy who runs Steph Butt Protection Agency has this Pareto principle, crazy talent, right? I mean, I watched a clip from the movie Moneyball, and Brad Pitt has the most dull lines, like, hey, I don't care. I give a rat's ass what your name is. But the way he does it, so calmly, so zen, staring straight at the guy, receptive, open. It's fat. He's just, you can't take your eyes off the guy, even when he's got his shirt on, which is, you know, not my favorite look for him. But, you know, there's some people, they're stars. They have that special it factor. You can't take your eyes off them, and so on. And they can't explain why they do it either, right? There's some famous actor who's like, how do you look so thoughtful on stage? He's like, I don't know. I think about my grocery list. You know, put me on stage thinking about my grocery list, I'm not a movie star, right? But, and so some people are just crazy talented at stuff. And so if Bob's Protection Agency or Steph Butt's Protection Agency is run by someone who's crazy talented, can just provide twice the service at half the cost because they're just so good at business, then they're just going to accumulate more and more customers, and then aren't you going to end up with something that's kind of like a government? And of course, everyone's going to have that concern. And so people will stop doing business with him if it looks like he's getting dangerous. But the most important thing, and this is more true, I think, of whoever's going to do geographical defense, you'd call it national defense, but it's not quite a nation state. So if we pay someone to have all of these weapons to protect us from invaders, or we pay a bunch of people to all coordinate together, then why don't they just take all these weapons and take us over? And that is, it's a very real concern, it's a real question. So anyone who wants to sell their services to you is going to have to prove to you that they're not going to do that. In other words, they're going to have to be independently audited. They're not going to be able to accumulate weaponry. And everyone's going to have, like, if you break one syllable of your contract rating is completely destroyed and you can't do business with anyone. So people are aware of the dangers of a protection agency becoming a state. And so all of those contracts will be built into those situations. In other words, if there's Bob's Protection Agency and Steph Butt's Protection Agency for like their armies, navies, whatever, Air Force, whatever you need to protect. Although I think basically you just need to go for foreign leaders, which I sort of talked about. I talk about in my novel, The Future, which you should definitely read, freedomaid.com/books. So if there's Bob's Defense Agency and Steph Butt's Defense Agency, and Steph Butt's Defense Agency, what I do is I say, listen, I'm aware that everyone's frightened I'm going to turn into a government. So here's all the steps I'm going to do to make sure that doesn't happen. All the fail safes, all the safeguards, all the independent audits, all of the trigger cascading legal ramifications. If one person can find one extra bomb or piece of artillery or anti-aircraft missile or something like that, then I will pay them a bounty of $10 million or something like that. And all that money's put in escrow and managed by a third party. So I would put a bounty on anyone who is focusing on proving that I'm doing something nefarious. And the other thing too, defense is way easier than taking over a country. So preventing someone from taking over your country is way cheaper and easier than taking over a geographical region. And so if he's trying to accumulate weapons to take over the local geographical region, he's going to have to charge a lot more money or get a lot more loans or something like that, because it's Bitcoin. You can't just create money or something like it. And so the economic signals of somebody trying to take over the country would be really bad. Also, all of the other defense agencies would keep an eye on each other because they don't want to lose their entire business by someone taking over the country. And also, people would be armed because it's a free society, so you can have weapons. So taking over the country would be crazy expensive. You'd just end up with it. They made a desert and called it peace, like you'd end up with nothing. So there would be tons of fail safes and so on, and it practically would be impossible. But the last thing, of course, is that if the worst conceivable situation from a free society is you end up being at risk of another government, it's still worth pursuing because we already have that government. They already have those governments anyway. So anyway, I really do appreciate the questions. Great questions. And I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about those again. We will move to Christian. Christian, thank you for your patience. I appreciate that. And if you want to unmute, I am all but the Dumbo ears. Going once, going twice.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Great. Thank you so much for bringing me on. So my question is mostly about how we can prevent paranoia from exacerbating or getting worse, or what we could potentially do to help people unwind a sense of paranoia. Because I think one of the palpable fears that we have right now is that certain bad actors have a sense of paranoia, which enables them to morally rationalize bad decisions and bad behaviors.
Can you give me an example? That's very abstract. I want to make sure I focus my answer on what's most pertinent to you.
Sure. I think the most direct way to describe it is to say that certain people who have a loyalty to a certain nation in the Middle East might worry about a very bad thing happening to them. And out of that fear, some of which, of course, is very well reasoned, but some of which might be, you know, higher than maybe they should feel, bad things are happening in the Middle East and potentially here overseas.
Yes, I think I can crack this indecipherable code. Let me ask you something that's, to me, a little bit more manageable, and we can certainly talk about that as well. Have you ever, I've dealt with someone in my life who's been paranoid. Have you ever dealt with an individual who shows signs of paranoia? I don't want to necessarily bypass the geopolitical stuff, but sometimes it can be easier to deal with a local example with our own direct experience.
Yes, my mom elicited a lot of fears about getting sick in the late 90s. And I remember her kind of acting frantically. And we didn't really know what to do about it. We would somewhat placate her, but we didn't seem to really know what to do in the moment.
So how did that behavior manifest for her?
So she got really sick doing a trip over to the Middle East that totally unrelated to what we're talking about now. But basically, she came back with a form of pneumonia because she went up on a big hike and she came back. And then she was fearful for years and years. And we didn't really know how to help her or really whether her symptoms or whether what she was, you know, thinking about was realistic. And so we kind of just, shelved ourselves and didn't know what to do.
And did your mother ever have significant issues with aggression in the past?
She certainly could lose her temper. She was very charismatic most of the time, but she could lose her temper if that's what you're talking about with anger.
How would she lose her temper? Like, how would that manifest and how often did it happen?
It could be yelling. It could be belittling. Those sorts of things. Basically, short fuse.
Okay. And how often might that show up?
It would show up pretty often. I was in a big family, and I was one of a number of boys. So you can imagine how five boys could be a little bit unmanageable.
Thank God. We like boys to be unmanageable. All right. And how often would she lose her temper, would you say?
Hard to compare to what the normal would be in the same sort of situation. But I would say, you know, we see her lose it every week. It wouldn't necessarily result in anything, you know, that would scar us or create some of those effects. But I don't know how to compare it, I guess. I just don't have another relevant example to compare to.
Was she a spanker at all?
No. It'd be more just like yelling.
And would she call names or just, "Oh, you kids are driving me crazy" kind of stuff, or exasperation?
It could be names, but that was less frequent.
What sort of names?
Hard to remember. I think most of it I put out of my mind. But I can't remember the names off the top of my head. I think I've mostly tried to forget about it.
You mean like, I know you say you can't remember, but is it stuff like "you idiots" or "you kids are dumb," or it wasn't as harsh as like "I wish I'd never been a mother"? I'm sure it wasn't anything like that, but was it just that sort of exasperated, "why are you so clumsy" or "you're such an idiot" or "you're so selfish"? Or was it anything sort of along those lines? Does that ring a bell at all?
Actually, it was more like the latter. More like "I can't believe I let you guys do this stuff," blah, blah, blah. It would be more descriptive and less pejorative. It'd be more like, "I can't believe we like pay for you guys to go on vacations or to like, you know, send you to school or like do something nice for you." It would sort of be like, retribution style, where it would be like the threat of potential retribution. It wouldn't be pejorative name calling so much so. More so like, "we regret doing things nice to you because you're acting in a way in which we don't consider to be, you know, permissible within our social class or milieu."
Okay. Got it. And did her aggression increase or decrease or stay about the same over the course of her life?
I think it got worse. I don't really know how that exactly works. I mean, I look at the boomer generation and I frequently wonder about the effects of like lead gasoline and whether certain mood and irritable behaviors come from that, or if that's just a normal process of getting older, because I don't remember other generations, including my grandparents, acting in the same style of ways that I see a lot more boomers reacting, where it seems like they're potentially more irritable and they don't seem to even listen as well as my grandparents did when they were alive at the same ages.
Right. So, I mean, one of the things to remember about the boomer generation is they were the first generation to be laser targeted by socialist and communist propaganda, because it took a while for the socialists and the communists to worm their way into the institutions in their sort of long march to the institutions. And so the boomers have been set against reality, which makes them irritable. See, if you're set against reality and that the past of this used to be, you know, you're sinful, all of your normal human impulses come from the devil, and you're sort of set against your own nature, you're set against your own humanity, you're set against your own biological side, and people get really irritable when they're at constant war with themselves, and people get really irritable when they're at constant war with reality. And I don't know what the case is with your mother, but certainly when I've had a lot of interaction with boomers over the years in the business world and other places, they have a random toddler's sensitivity and opposition to basic facts. I mean, the IQ stuff and ethnicity stuff that I've talked about, it was boomers who freaked out because they'd been raised in a different way. And they were the most propagandized generation because they were hit with all the propaganda, but it was prior to the internet, which gave people counter-propaganda. So they're the most propagandized generation in human history. I mean, you could argue, of course, you know, well, what about the Middle Ages and religion? But they would, that's religion. That's a little bit different from propaganda. And so, like, religion says there's a higher world that's more important, not up is down, black is white, two and two make five, war is peace, freedom is slavery, and all of that stuff that goes on in socialist propaganda or communist propaganda. So they have founded their entire personalities on falsehoods, which makes them incredibly touchy. Because also, as people age, right, so if boomers were open borders people, which generally they were if they were propagandized that way, then if they're seeing negative effects from open borders, they can't process it. That they have founded, like, once you can get people to found their identities on falsehoods, then they get very touchy. They can't handle facts. They get very aggressive. They get very punchy because if they're wrong about everything, then they, it's like they're psychologically, they cease to exist. The cognitive dissonance in the boomers is higher than just about every generation, certainly every modern generation. So I think that's really important to understand. The other thing too that I've noticed is that the people, this is why I asked about aggression, is that people who are paranoid are often unconsciously expecting blowback for their own aggression. And so if you've been very aggressive out there in the world, let's just say Sally, whatever, Sally is, you know, she's yelled at her children, she's been very aggressive, maybe she's been manipulative. And when any of her children come to her with facts that she disagrees with or facts that go against her sensibilities, she, you know, rolls her eyes, she gets kind of aggressive, she pulls that, you know, that, how could you, like, that's so weird, you know, that there was a woman in England who was talking about immigration and housing and just made this twisted, holding in a fart face, which is what people do who've been heavily propagandized when they come across counterfactuals. They just can't process it. And all they do is eye roll and signal that this guy's just weird. Like, why would you even think that? It's just so bizarre, right? And this was the conflict I had with someone last week who said that my perspectives on biology were just bizarre. And it's like, bizarre is not an argument. It's very girly and it's not an argument. Just so bizarre. Like, yeah, but can you actually make a case? So my guess would be, with regards to your mother, that if she's put out a lot of aggression in the world, if you put out a lot of aggression in the world, then you unconsciously are awaiting blowback. Mm-hmm. And if it's getting worse, it means that, I mean, you can undo some of the aggression that you put out in the world, but that means you've got to humble yourself and apologize. And if you apologize, then you can reduce the chances of blowback, right? And so groups who portray themselves as victims are often putting out a lot of aggression in the world, and then they expect blowback, and that makes them very aggressive and punchy. This happens in just about every society and just about every group as a whole. So when I look at somebody who's paranoid, I look at somebody who's probably put out a lot of aggression into the world and is waiting for blowback, and thus is, I mean, my mother was the same way. My mother, I don't want to make this a competition, but I think my mother was probably worse. My mother put out a lot of aggression and hostility into the world, and then she slept with a big giant bread knife under her pillow and was very jumpy and thought everyone was out to get her. And it's like, because that karma thing, I mean, it's not like karma is a real force or anything like that, but you generally get out the energy, you get back from the world the energy that you put out into the world, right? So I approach everyone super friendly, make a couple of jokes, give them a compliment if it's reasonable, and everybody is like super friendly back. It's something my daughter and I were chatting about last night. But if you go and you're sort of cold and guarded and hostile, people would tend to treat you more negatively. So mostly people will bounce back the energy or the positivity or the negativity that you put out. If people have been kind of negative and hostile, then they have accumulated a kind of psychological debt, which they expect to be paid back at some point. And that often shows up as, you know, people are out to get me. And it's like, well, maybe you've put enough negative energy or hostility out there in the world that people are going to be kind of hostile to you and not supportive of you. And therefore, that makes you kind of jumpy. Does that help at all?
It definitely gives me a bunch of thoughts. I guess the first thing I thought about was actually when you were a small child and maybe you'd get a cookie out of the cookie jar when you're not supposed to. And then you'd be sort of operating from a sense of fear, knowing that you sort of broke the rules, but thinking that because you've been punished before, that now, like, you're actually in sort of a weird spot where you enjoyed what you did right away because you got that immediate gratification. But then you're operating from a sense of, if not paranoia, you're definitely anxious because you think that you could be punished, you know, anytime, sometime in the future. And I wonder if that's sort of like the winding of the gears that happens within people psychologically, where people get away with something and then from thenceforth, they then built in a defense mechanism to try to either rationalize it or I don't know.
Yeah, I think that I certainly know that in my own childhood, there were entire stretches of my childhood where I could be gotten for something, you know, like I was the last one to use the flashlight. The flashlight was supposed to be in some drawer. I can't remember, like I was like 7 or 8. I can't remember what happened to the flashlight, but I know the flashlight is missing. And our power would go out on a fairly regular basis. There were these sort of rolling brownouts and blackouts when I was a kid because the coal miners were on strike and stuff like that. And so I would be like, please God, don't let the lights go out, because then my mother's going to look for the flashlight. She won't be able to find the flashlight. And God help me if she remembers that I was the last one with the flashlight. I mean, I can try and gaslight her and so on, but I'm going to get beaten. I'm going to get beaten bad, right? So, and there were just a couple of things usually that would be floating around, like if I would lose my keys, keys to get into the apartment building, keys to get into our apartment. And keys were like $1. I used to cut keys in the hardware store. They were pretty cheap and we were pretty broke, but we could afford $1 for a key, right? But I could never tell my mother that I had lost my keys, because my mother believed that if I'd lost my keys, people were going to break into our house, even though my keys had no name, no label. If I'd lost my keys somewhere, I could never explain it to her, even though it made sense. Like if I'd lost my keys and somebody found a key ring with two little keys on it with no address, no name, no nothing somewhere out in the world, they weren't going to come. I said, I remember saying to her, like, they'd have to go and try every apartment building. And then there are like, you know, 100 apartments in this building. They'd have to go up and down each, you know, corridor, trying each key. Like, it's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. Right. And for what? We've got nothing. We've got nothing. We're broke. Like, people aren't going to. So I tried to explain that. And so I didn't have any money when I was little. It's one of the reasons I got, you know, first job when I was 10, because I needed to be able to cut some keys. And so I would wait until my mother left in the morning, and then I would leave our door unlocked, and then I would go to school, and I would come back home, and I would just wait for someone to let me in the building, and then I would go. And so we were actually more at, quote, risk, because my mother wouldn't let me get a key, because I never had any money for lunch out, so I'd always have to come home and try and gnaw on whatever golem fish bones were lying around the apartment. And so, but if my mother were ever to say, where's your key? Where are your keys? Right. Mm-hmm. And then I'd have to sort of pretend that I lost them that day. And then she'd get really angry. And now we've got to change the locks. I'm like, we really don't have to change the locks, you know, but it was all that kind of. So, I mean, if you can be gotten for something and it's sort of floating around and you can't resolve it, right? Like, I can't just go to my mom and say, listen, I don't know where my keys are. I've checked with my friends. I've checked around the house. Like, I'm sorry, but we're going to need to get some new keys. You know, she can obviously say, you know, try to be more careful, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, stuff happens. You know, when you're out there with shorts on and you've got keys in your pocket and you're climbing trees and like every now and then the keys are just going to fall out, get lost or whatever. It's going to happen, but it doesn't put the shitty food, the Nescafe and, you know, our moldy old couch, it doesn't put them in much danger. People aren't going to be trying to break into our crappy little apartment. Mm-hmm. And so when you can't negotiate or rationalize with people and they can get you for stuff, even if it's completely irrational, then yeah, you get a little jumpy. But you also get used to just dealing with people having stuff over you, which has actually been quite helpful for me in my career as a whole, if that makes sense.
So I have a question in regards to this. So if we can't persuade the paranoid person to change their viewpoint by us using logic and trying to discuss with them or, you know, persuade them with our own rationalization or logic, could we invert that dynamic, you think, and maybe have them try to explain to us and where we play dumb and say, hey, listen, I want to understand what you mean, but I guess I don't really understand. Could you explain it to me for me? Because maybe then would they maybe if we were able to get them to explain the reasoning, maybe they would hear their own reasoning falter. Would that be, you think, maybe a way to down ramp that paranoia or get them to sort of like unwind their unrationalized position?
Okay. And I mean, I'm sure you tried a variety of things with your own mother and her paranoia or jumpiness. Did you ever have any luck with any approach that you took?
Not much. I will say that if I played dumb, that sometimes I would sort of get her to fall into that trap a little bit, where if she knows like she doesn't have any logic, like actually what happens is she doesn't know that she doesn't have logic. She then will try to explain, and then about halfway through an argument, realize that she's messed up. And I can use that to unwind her confidence and her willingness to be aggressive about it. Mm. So long as I don't like dig in or like, you know, try to get her to concede or like rub it in at all. If I instead let it go, then she will just try to pretend it never happened. And she will actually lessen her investment and sunk cost fallacy into whatever like viewpoint she had.
Right. So if people have made a mistake in their thinking, which has caused distorted emotions, and they have a commitment to the truth, then you can prove to them that their thinking is distorted. They will accept that their thinking is distorted. They will apply better reasoning, and their emotions will, over time, follow suit. Right? So if somebody thinks that they're being hunted, then they're going to be jumpy, looking over their shoulder. And if it turns out, like, let's say somebody reports a crime, and it turns out that they think it's the son of the mafia chief who committed the crime, and now the mafia is hunting them, right? And they're jumpy and so on, but that would make sense, right? But let's say it turns out, no, the guy who's the son of the mafia chief is still out there running around. It's just someone who looks like him. It's just some criminal, right? There's no, this big crime organization that's now after you. They're going to relax, right? I think everyone has had a situation in life where you think you're in danger, and then you realize you're not in danger, and then you relax, right? And so on, right? Mm-hmm. And so if somebody's upset, emotional upset, is the result of distorted thinking, and this is kind of the reasoning behind cognitive behavioral therapy, which is challenging irrational beliefs. So if somebody has just made a thinking error or made an assumption that is false or some logical error, and therefore they have these emotions because they believe something that's false, then if you give them the true perspective, then they will with great relief say, oh, thank you. Oh my gosh, I'm so relieved, blah, 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 right? If somebody calls you in a panic and says, oh my God, my car has been stolen with everything I treasure in it and blah, 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 blah. And then you say, and they're panicking, they're freaking out. And you say, bro, you lent me your car 2 days ago. And they just woke up and forgot that for some reason. What will they say? They'll say, oh my God, oh, thank you so much. Oh my God, I was freaking out. Huge relief, blah, 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 blah. Because they had a distorted idea, which gave them a certain emotional state of panic or anxiety. They realize that the car isn't stolen. They lent it and forgot about it. And then they have huge relief. So those are things that happen. They're very rare in long-term problems. So a woman who's cheating on her husband will often nag at him and maybe accuse him of looking at other women and so on. And she's doing that because of her own guilt, and the best defense is a good offense, right? Accuse other people of what you're actually doing is a standard tactic among corrupt people. So for the husband to say, I wasn't looking at her, or it was just a glance or whatever, the purpose of her attacks upon him is not because she has distorted thinking, but because she's a bad person who's cheating on him, and she's trying to throw him off the scent for whatever reason until she makes a decision or something like that. So if somebody is stealing from your business and you are talking to that person, like say you've got an accountant who's stealing from you, like they do all the time in the music industry, apparently. Sting went to court about this. So if you've got an accountant who's stealing money from you and you start talking about an outside auditor coming in to check the books, that accountant is going to, oh, that's a terrible idea. That's crazy. You're going to waste your money. It's going to, you should go write songs and tour and you, like whatever it is, right? He's going to be, now, it's not because he's got distorted thinking. It's because he doesn't want to get caught for stealing money from you, right? So that's kind of the deal. So if people have mistaken thoughts that will result in negative emotions, and you correct those thoughts, those emotions will, over time, maybe not right away, be resolved. It's not like the moment you find out that you'd lent your car rather than it being stolen, your heart rate doesn't immediately go back to normal, but you know, you start to calm down. Whew, thank goodness, right? So if, however, the person has emotions based upon guilt or blowback from prior aggression or a desire to bully, like if somebody is just a bully to you, it doesn't really matter what you do. They'll just be a bully to you. And so then you can't fix those emotions by appealing to their reason, because reason is not the source of their emotions, or irrationality is not the source of their emotions. It is some knotted up emotional, often moral issue, like cheating on your husband, or, you know, if a parent has been really violent towards you, then that parent often will be paranoid later in life because they're just waiting for that blowback, right? And if they're religious, then they're waiting for God's punishment, and they just get very jumpy and so on. And so for me, when I was like, oh man, I'm jumpy because I don't know where the flashlight is, and if the power goes out, my mom's going to beat the hell out of me if she can't find the flashlight. Well, if I find the flashlight and put it back in the drawer, whew, I'm fine, right? Because the problem is the fear of violence from the flashlight being missing. And so if I find the flashlight, put it back, my emotions are solved, right? Mm-hmm. But if somebody is attacking their husband because she's cheating on him and wants to throw him off the scent, there's no amount of reasoning that's going to solve that problem, because the problem is not coming from any thinking. It is coming from an emotional driver like guilt or... And does that sort of make sense? So you can't reason people out of stuff Yes. that is not the result of a logical problem.
Yes, it definitely makes sense. And so the follow-up question would be, is there a good way you found to differentiate between the two so you could understand which subset the person you're dealing with is falling under?
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, I mean, and I say this as a result of bitter experience, not because it's blindingly obvious or anything like that. But sure, if somebody has a mistaken perspective and the strong emotions that often come with their mistaken perspective, then you try to correct their perspective. And somebody who's experiencing negative emotions is hungry, if it's coming from a logical error, they're incredibly grateful if you fix their thinking, right? So somebody thinks, oh my God, the mafia is hunting me because I turned in the son of the mafia lord. And then you say, actually, no, that guy's still out there. They're like, oh, thank you, thank you. Oh, hey, I can relax, you know, that kind of stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so if somebody has negative emotions as a result of distorted thinking, when you correct that distorted thinking, they're incredibly grateful and happy and thankful. If somebody has negative emotions as the result of guilt or former aggression or an expectation of blowback, or because they enjoy the feeling of false moral superiority for, you know, virtue signaling and so on, then if you expose their distorted thinking, they get aggressive and angry. They're not thankful. They're not thankful. You know, there's these jokes. It's kind of you see these physical comedy things in movies where, mm-hmm. Somebody throws a suitcase away because it's going to explode. And then somebody says, oh, you brought your suitcase, and they put it back to them and walk off. And the guy's like, oh no, right? Whereas if you lose your suitcase or you drop your suitcase and someone brings it to you, you're like, oh, thank you. My God, I'm so, if you ever try to leave a plane and you leave something in the overhead bin and somebody says, hey, whose is this? Is somebody leave? And oh, that's mine. Oh, thank gosh. Right. Or whatever. Right. You're thankful. So if you try to correct people's thinking and they get aggressive and they get manipulative and so on, like, what was it last week? There was a guy calling in about UPB and he was saying, these aren't proofs, right? And so I said, human beings are alive as the result of following universally preferred behavior, such as eating, drinking, and so on. And of course, he couldn't even inhale to answer that without breathing. So he couldn't even answer the question without the universe. If you ever tried, everyone tries this at some point when you're a kid, like, how long can I talk until I run out of oxygen completely, right? So he couldn't even have the debate without inhaling. And so breathing is universally preferable behavior just for having a debate. And he accused me of a wide variety of logical fallacies and so on, such as begging the question. And I'm like, identifying a biological fact is not begging the question. Animals are carbon-based life forms. And that's begging the question. It's like, no, it's just an identification of a fact, right? And so he was not, and this is why I dumped the conversation. He's not having a question that he really wants a solution. He just has, I assume he has a bad conscience. UPB represents the conscience, and his conscience was bothering him. UPB was bothering him. And so he wanted to come out and discredit me and UPB for emotional reasons, not because he's interested in the pursuit of the truth. And again, it's not like I hold the truth uniquely and exclusively, but identifying physical facts is not begging the question at all. And then he's accused me of equivocation. And again, these are just terms that sound fancy, but aren't magic spells that prove people wrong. So when I was talking with him, and I would never talk with someone like that privately for that long, but publicly it's useful to point out when somebody's not interested in pursuing truth, but just wants to throw roadblocks for their own emotional reasons. It's when you give a solution to someone and they don't accept it. They move the goalposts, they change the definitions, and they're not grateful for the answer. If that makes sense. And this is with the first caller. If he's not grateful for the answer, I'm like, okay, so is he just firing a series of questions, trying to hope to catch me out? Because if he's not showing any appreciation for the answer, or at least the effort that went into the answer, I'm concerned that he's just throwing out question after question in the hopes of tripping me up. So when I provide a good answer, that's negative for him, because his goal is to trip me up and have me not be able to answer something. So then he's just going to keep moving to more, like if he's throwing balls, hoping to hit my head and I keep catching them, he's just going to keep throwing balls. He's not going to say thank you for catching it because he wants to hit me in the head. And I'm not saying that's the case of the first caller. I don't know, but that would be a concern, if that makes sense.
Great. You've really helped me clarify what seems to be the framework. I'm not sure if I'm able to label this correctly, but basically it sounds like what you're saying is that if someone were to express concern for someone who you think might have a paranoia, and then that person, instead of appreciating that sense of concern, would lash out or, you know, get aggressive in response, that would be a key tell that they're going on the defensive, and maybe, you know, this is not a person who's acting in good faith, and you can really spot that pretty quickly. It makes me also think of, as a parallel, what happens when you compliment a narcissist, where a narcissist, at least in my personal experience, they hate being humanized, where you could say something nice about them, but that isn't a grandiose nature of a compliment, and they'll actually get annoyed or angry at you. And that was one of the best ways personally that I've been able to distinguish a narcissist.
Yes, if somebody recognizes that a negative emotional state is a problem to be solved, and they try to get solutions to the problem, that to me seems like an honorable thing. If somebody's negative emotional state is resistant to all answers or solutions or feedback, you know, in this sort of famous story I've told of my mother at Pizza Hut, where I just said maybe she should read a couple of books on stress because everyone out to get her is very stressful, and then she like ended up throwing the pitcher of Pepsi at me. I mean, that's somebody that, sorry, you don't want any solutions to the problem. And I spent a lot of years trying to give people solutions to that which they secretly loved, right? And that was not a good idea. And I appreciate the questions. Thank you so much. Really, really good stuff to talk about. And it's sad that we have experience dealing with people who have paranoia, but it is a real thing. All right, let's do Brubsky. If you wanted to give me your questions or comments or criticisms, I am thrilled to hear.
Hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me? Anybody here?
You are very faint. I'm going to need you to get closer to your microphone.
I'm sorry, Steph. For some reason, I can't hear you.
Dale.
Oh, are we back?
Oh, are we back?
Oh, we are.
I'm back.
Okay, go ahead.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Okay, sorry. I'm getting an echo from you.
Do you not have headphones? Do you not have headphones?
I'll turn down the volume for this. I'm sorry. I'm
just going to ask a question, and then we won't be able to engage in a dialogue. So go ahead.
Okay. I heard an argument on a Dave Smith debate with a conservative podcast or a conservative streamer. He had the question of, it was a question against libertarian ethics. I want to know if UPB could take a stab at it. He said that. He asked Dave Smith if libertarian ethics would forbid, if a person wanted to engage in bad acts with like a dead animal or something. I know it's a very vulgar example, but Dave didn't have a good answer for it, and neither did I. And I just wanted to know if UPB or you could take a stab at answering this question. That's it.
Okay, I appreciate that. Let me just. I'm sorry to mute you in, but we got a wicked echo. So, okay, that's interesting. So with regards to somebody who's committing lewd acts with a dead animal, that is not a violation of UPB. That is not a violation of UPB. However, it is a sign of such wildly deep emotional, intellectual, and moral dysfunction that nobody will want to have anything to do with you unless you go and get some help with your completely bizarre bang a skunk fetish or something like that. So, I mean, it is obviously not a violation of the non-aggression principle to copulate with a dead elk or something like that. Now we have the thumbnail. But of course, we all know that if somebody is doing something like that, they are insanely disturbed and creepy and will be a grave danger as a whole. Because if you're willing to do that, what are you not willing to do? And so on, right? So if you find some dead animal in the forest and you put on some Barry White and lay a tablecloth and, you know, prop the dead elk's sightless eyes up on the tablecloth and ask it about, you know, hey, how's your life been? And how did you end up here? And, you know, the bugs in your eye sockets really do bring out the gleam. You know, and it looks like you're smiling the whole time because your lips have been mostly eaten away by chipmunks. And I just don't think I've ever felt closer to anyone or anything. And this may seem kind of forward, but I was just wondering if I could cop a feel in the hole where your front leg used to be before the wolves tore it off. You got it going on, man. I don't think I've ever felt quite as strong a pull. Anyway, I could do that all day. Let's not, though, for the sake of it being memeable. But if you end up wooing and romancing an animal corpse and then deciding to make the beast with two backs with a beast with no back, then you are clearly morally deranged and of great danger to society, and society would not be able to punish you for a direct violation of the non-aggression principle, of course, assuming it wasn't someone's pet, because you still own the body even after, and that would be violating somebody else's property or somebody else's livestock or something. Let's just say some random animal in the woods. Again, I know this is extreme. So in a society, you would not be punished for a direct violation of the non-aggression principle, but you would be ostracized because it would be such an indication of inhuman moral corruption that people would find it too risky to have anything to do with you. So you would be punished because it's just so repulsive what you did that there would be of massive negative consequences to you socially and so on. So that was fairly quick. Let's do one more. Skindy, what is on your mind? Thank you for the tip. I appreciate freedomain.com/donate if you'd like to help out the show. Skindy, you may be muted. You may be unmuted. I am not sure. Going once, going twice. Yes, no.
Hello,
maybe.
Stefan.
Hello.
Thank you so much for letting me on your speaker panel. It's been great listening to you for many years, since 2014, 15. I have two questions today. One may have a longer answer. One may have a shorter answer. My first question is, why is it so difficult to spot the covert narcissist when it's a female? And my second question is, one thing I particularly enjoyed about your content were the call-in shows. I learned much from those. If you would recommend those, I'd love to know when that would happen or if that would happen at all. Thank you.
Yeah, call-in shows are still coming out, so they're still going on. In fact, they are at least half, if not more, of the content. So just go to fdpodcast.com, sign up for the feed. They generally are labeled call-in shows. I have a whole bunch in the queue. I'm actually kind of at sixes and sevens because I've got a whirly gig of crazy complicated call-in shows to work on, and I don't have a lot of time at the moment for a variety of reasons. So yeah, call-in shows are still going. Now, with regards to covert narcissists being hard to detect with regards to women, the answer tends to be cleavage. So if you look down, I've got a little bit going on there, a little bit of little bit of Mariana Trench chest hair going on, a little bit of cleavage. So it is because men's genes are seeking the egg, and the men who refused to date or sleep with covert narcissists, and if the covert narcissist was the only person around, those genes died out. So morally, men have evolved to hold their nose and reproduce at almost any cost. You know, I was moderating a debate yesterday at wordwardebate.com. I was moderating a debate, and the woman was complaining that men are aggressive, or was talking about men being aggressive. And it's like, well, of course men are aggressive, because all throughout human evolution, people ran out of food, they ran out of resources, and they would go and raid their neighbors. Because all of those men and women or whoever who refused to go and raid their neighbors and try and take stuff by force, they just died out. At least if you go and try to take your neighbor's stuff by force, you have a chance of survival. You have a chance of survival. And so aggression is been positively selected for in terms of evolution. So of course, men tend to be aggressive. And so men will choose to reproduce with a covert narcissist if she is the best or only option available, because men who had very high moral standards and would only have children with the highest moral categories of women or non-crazy dysfunctional women. Why is there a hot crazy matrix? Because men have to reproduce. That is the biological imperative. Or to put it another way, the men who were willing to sleep with the covert narcissist, if the covert narcissist was the only one available, those genes reproduced. And so this is why men have, quote, lower standards than women, and they should, right? Not because women are low standards, just because male investment is much less. Women should have higher standards because their investment in reproduction is obviously almost infinitely higher than a man's, you know, because after a mere 2.5 hours of lovemaking, right? So women, of course, still have to bear the children, carry and bear the children, raise the children, and so on. And so it is hard for men to detect the covert narcissist, because you would detect the covert narcissist in order to avoid the covert narcissist. Now, if you're married to a good woman and there are covert narcissists around, you would detect them and try and get rid of them. But that's the minority of men throughout human history. And most people throughout human history were various stages of crazy and corrupt, just because we didn't really have modern understanding and freedom and so on. So yeah, the narcissist thing is really just based on the male reproductive incentive, in that, you know, 10 to 15 times more women than men would reproduce at times throughout human history. And we can see this. There's this woman who says, I'd rather be a temporary fleshlight for a 10 than a domestic servant and sex slave to a 5 in terms of like male attractiveness. And so, and you know, I'm not even going to complain about that. Women's hypergamy is why we've got to the top of the food chain. So these are descriptive, not prescriptive, but men cannot afford to avoid reproductive opportunities, because they were quite rare at many times throughout human history. And women tend to be very picky and upward looking when it comes to reproduction. So men can't be as choosy and men can't be as picky. And we see this, like these studies where some attractive woman is hired to go and approach men in the bars and offer sex. Most men say yes. An attractive man is goes to a woman in a bar and offer sex. Almost all women say no, for sort of obvious evolutionary reasons. So freedomain.com/donate to help out the show. Really do appreciate your questions, comments, issues, challenges, criticisms, and feedback is all delightfully and gratefully and humbly appreciated. Shop.freedomain.com for your merch, freedomain.com/books for your books, peacefulparenting.com for your shares of the great book, and call.freedomain.com to book your call-in shows, paid or private. It's absolutely up to you. Lots of love, everyone. Thank you for a great, great show. Fantastic questions, great interactions. Lots of love, my friends. I'll talk to you soon.